So what I want to do, if this is okay with you guys, I want to start just by talking about my house purchase and Tony Resco, because that's something that I know you guys have editorialized on, suggesting that you know, we haven't provided you guys enough information. I would love to have an exhaustive conversation about all aspects of it, and ensure that by the time we leave here today, you may not be happy with all my answers, but at least you can't say that I have not answered the questions. Is that fair?
Sounds good.
And in preparation for this meeting, what I wanted to do was... Hey, how are you?
Good, how are you?
In preparation for this meeting, what I instructed my attorney to do and my staff to do, and you know, Michelle and I also did, was just to go through everything pertaining to it. We've prepared a doc. Flynn has it. There you go. Okay, so we've got a, it's got all the documents related to our side of the transaction. And, you know, as well as an email from the sellers confirming some key points that I'll be making during the course of my initial presentation, and then we can follow up with any of those issues later. So here's what I'd like to do is start off by just laying out the context of my relationship with Tony Resco so that people understand how the house purchase came about and how the lot purchase came about. I first met, and by the way, one last point I want to make on this, many of these things are points that have been raised in previous stories and have been asked and we felt had been answered, but I want to just reiterate it once again and then we can fill out anything else. I first met Tony Resco when I was still at law school, or at least I had just graduated from law school. He had two partners, a guy named Dan Maru and David Brent. They had started a real estate company called Resmar. They contacted me while I was the president of the Harvard Law Review and asked if I was coming back to Chicago and was thinking about future employment, would I be interested in potentially getting involved in development? And so when I was back in Chicago, and I don't recall whether it was during the summer between you know, my second and third year or whether it was after I had graduated or whether it was just visiting Michelle, I met with them. They were didn't talk to me about a specific job, but explained what they were doing in terms of development. Because I'd been a community organizer, I think that's part of what prompted their interest, because they were doing a lot of affordable housing work and work with community development corporations. I had a relatively brief conversation, maybe 45 minutes, and ultimately declined to go into development. But and that was the first time I met Tony Resco. Hey, good to
All
see
right,
you, Scott.
How are you?
How are you? I'm doing
good.
Well.
Good.
How are you?
Back.
Nice to see you. Fast forward a little bit. I did not have a lot of interactions with Tony at that point. I was working as an associate at a law firm. There may have been interactions with my law firm and some of the development partners of Resmar, because they would often partner with non-for-profits, and we had a small transactional practice in the law firm that specialized in representing non-for-profits, you know, church-based organizations that were doing community development. I don't recall exactly how many times at that point I'd met Tony Resco, but I don't think at that point I would have considered him a friend. He was an acquaintance. When I decided to run for the state Senate, the way that I decided to run for the state Senate was I had been helping Alice Palmer, who was then running for Congress. She had asked me to help. She was giving up her seat, and I was I got involved in her campaign, and some people asked me if I'd be interested potentially in taking her seat. Tony Resco, I think, had provided some assistance to her at that time. So I think that may be the first time where we started talking about politics. he agreed to support my Senate campaign. He was an active developer on the South Side, and so he had some relationships with some of the aldermen in the area that I did not have relationships with, and he introduced me to them. It's hard to imagine given the kind of fundraising I'm doing now, but the total amount that I raised for that first race was $100,000. And I think it's fair to say, and this is an estimate, that Tony Rusko probably raised $10,000 to $15,000 of that $10,000. I can't say precisely because I no longer have those records, but I think that's probably a rough guesstimate. As a consequence of that support, we became friendlier, and I would probably talk to him maybe 5 to 6 months a year. We might have breakfast or we might have lunch. At that time, I knew him as a businessman who also had an interest in politics, but did not know the details of his various business interactions. When I ran for Congress, I asked him if he'd be interested in supporting me, as I asked a number of people all across the city who I thought might be interested in the race. It was a difficult decision for him because he had a relationship with Bobby Rush, but he nevertheless agreed to support me over Bobby Rush. And I would say in my congressional race, I raised about $600,000 total. I can't say exactly how much he raised, but I'd say, you know, he was on my finance committee along with a number of other people. My guess is he might have raised 50 to 75. That would be my guess. And obviously I appreciated his support. I lost that race, as all of you have recorded amply. And so I remained then in the state Senate and continued to see Tony maybe socially for breakfast or lunch maybe 4 or 5 times a year. Probably the only time that we got together with our spouses. There was one occasion where he invited us up to Lake Geneva with his family. We stayed there. We were there for the day. And there was another occasion where as couples, he and his wife and Michelle and I went to a restaurant here in Chicago. So friends, but not constant constant interaction. And right after my congressional race, as some of you will recall, that's when Tony Rusko, that's when Rob Blagojevich started running for governor. And Tony became a very important part of the governor's core political team. So he was fairly busy with that. I was working in the Senate. Didn't have as many interactions with him at that time. And it wasn't until I decided that I was running for the United States Senate that we started having a lot of conversations about politics again. I expressed my interest, described how I thought this race might go, and he ultimately ended up supporting me and was a part of our finance committee, was listed as part of our finance committee. Again, at that time, there were no indications that he was involved in anything inappropriate. And I would say that our best assessment and the money that we've identified that he raised for us was about $160,000 during my U.S. Senate primary. And all that money has been returned, by the way. Now, the only other things I'll say about the relationship that I think are important, he never asked me to do anything when I was in the state Senate. At no time did he ask for any favors from the government. In fact, most of the time, until he started becoming active with the Blagojevich campaign, he didn't really have that many interests before state government. He was active, I think, at the local level as a developer. And so he constantly had things going before the city council and probably the county, but there was really no occasion for me to help him in any significant way. The one exception that I know of that he did have an interest in down in Springfield was on gaming. He was one of the minority investors in the Emerald Casino. And you'll recall there was a big to-do about that. And in that circumstance, actually, I was firmly opposed to gaming and some of the proposals that were being made down in Springfield. And he never pressured me in any way to get involved in that process in any meaningful way. So my relationship to him was as somebody who had been a supporter, who had always been above board, who had always been gracious to me and my family, who had not offered me gifts or inducements that would lead me to be suspicious of him, and who had supported me even in times where it was not politically easy for him to do. That's the context in which my relationship and friendship with Tony evolved. So, just fast forward, I win the Senate's race, we go to Washington, because of the good fortune of publicity, my books start selling, I have more money, our kids are growing, and we become interested in moving out of our condo and buying a house. So at that point, I contact our broker who had helped us buy our condo, a woman named Miriam Zeltzerman, and who was with a real estate agency called Urban Search, which is very prominent in the Hyde Park area, and told her that we'd like to list our condominium for sale and that we were interested in buying a new house. I was in Washington much of this time, so this is the beginning of 2005, or somewhere in 2005. So Michelle started taking some tours with Miriam, and at some point ends up being shown the house which we now live in on Greenwood. Michelle calls me and says, I love this house, but it's more than we were talking about paying for, but I really think it's a great house. You should go take a look at it. I did, and I also thought it was a terrific house. And what the seller's broker described to me was that the way that the house was configured, it had this huge yard on the side, on the south side of the lot, that the lot had already been divided in half, that the lot was being sold separately, that somebody already had an option on the lot, so that was not part in any way of the transaction. And that the house was listed at 1.9, but in conversations with my broker afterwards, she said that although the lot had an option on it, the house had been on the market for quite some time. I think originally the sellers had tried to sell it as just in one big chunk, both the lot and the house, and it had been on the market for at least 6 months, maybe close to a year. They hadn't been successful. That's part of the reason why I think they divided it. The lot was apparently fairly attractive, and they had gotten offers on that. The house was the thing that was difficult for them to sell. And it was owned by a pair of doctors named the Wandersfords, who were at the University of Chicago. They had to join Johns Hopkins because they had gotten a new job, so they were moving, and so they were anxious to sell. So I then discussed it with Michelle as well as our broker and said, well, maybe it's worthwhile us putting down an offer, but we should get a better sense of what it's valued. And our broker said, you know, you certainly shouldn't be paying the list price on this because it might be a little bit overpriced. And so at that point, Michelle and I talked about who did we know who knew Kenwood who might have a sense of these properties. And that's how Tony Rusko's name came up, because he was an active developer in that area and owned lots in that area and had done development in that area. So I don't know, I don't remember exactly how this transpired, whether it was in a face-to-face meeting or I called Tony or what have you, but I said, I'd like your opinion on this property. He asked where it was. I told him. He said, well, I'm going to be in the neighborhood. I might go by and take a look at it. I think he may have done so prior to me being with him, but I don't recall exactly how that conversation transpired. The bottom line was that he said, well, he called me back or we spoke, and he said, if you want me to take a look at it, I'd be willing to go into the house and take a look at it. And I said, great. I arranged it with my broker. He and I looked at the house. He said, this looks like a very sturdy house. And at that point, I think he had found out, perhaps because he knew the seller's broker, that the person who was who had the option on the lot was also the person who had renovated this house 6 years ago. It had gone through a gut renovation 6 years ago. That individual was a former employee of Tony's who was also a fellow developer. Tony asked me during the course of one of these conversations why I might not be interested in buying the lot and keep the property intact. And I said that, you know, it wasn't worth it to us to spend an extra $600,000 or so on a lot next door when Michelle and I were really interested in the house. So he said, well, I might be interested in purchasing the lot. And my response was, that would be fine. That, you know, and my thinking at the time, and this is, you know, just to sort of flag this, this is an area where, you know, I can see sort of a lapse in judgment, where I could have said, you know, I'm not sure that's a great idea. But my view at the time when he expressed an interest was that he was a developer in this area that owned lots, that he thought it was going to be a good investment. And my interest or my motivation was, here's somebody that I knew who, if this lot was being developed, it'd be better to have somebody who knew, who I knew, who, you know, would give me schedules and keep me apprised of what was taking place and so forth. So I didn't object. He then said, well, let me look into it since I know the guy who has the option on the lot. And in the meantime, we simply proceeded to then get an inspector to come in, take a look at the house. It passed inspection. And so we decided to put down a sales contract. We put down a sales contract, or we put down an offer of 1.3. The sellers came back. They lowered their offer. I think it was to 1.8 or 1.75. We raised our offer to 1.5. And all this was done through our respective brokers. The issue of the lot and the lot price never came up. It was never an issue in our purchase. Tony Resco was not involved in those negotiations. Those were negotiations between our brokers. And we ended up agreeing to a sale price of 1.65. I have in the documents a statement by the sellers indicating that at no time did they ever consider the lot in relation to the price of the house, that they did not offer a discount on the house, that there was no contingency with respect to our house purchase relative to the lot. There was simply no connection between our purchase of the house and our price of the house and the sale of the lot. As I indicated before, the lot was already for sale. I wasn't involved in that transaction. I'm not aware of how Tony ended up getting the option from the previous individual. That was not something that I was concerned with. I didn't know exactly what the price was that he paid. I knew that there had been an option there for $600 and something because the broker had told me when I had first gone to visit. But the notion, and this is the area I want to be absolutely clear, because, you know, frankly, this has appeared in various reports, or the intimation, and John, you've been very specific about this, this notion that somehow I got a discount and Resco overpaid or was somehow involved in that is simply not true. And the sellers have confirmed that it is simply not true. Resco bought this, and I don't know his motives. And I think it is perfectly legitimate to say that he perhaps thought that it would be nice to have a lot next to me. He perhaps thought that this would strengthen our relationship. He could have even thought he was doing me a favor. But I also think that he thought that he was engaging in a sound business practice and that he was going to develop the property. And the fact that there wasn't some steep discount is in part borne out by the fact that he transferred the lot to his attorney. His attorney put it on the market, and it appears that a sale is about to be consummated on the property for a price that I think reflects the legitimate value of that lot. So that's the house purchase, and the intimation that somehow the purchase of my house was somehow aided by Tony Resco is simply factually incorrect, and it has been confirmed by the sellers that that is factually incorrect. The next phase then is the strip of land that we bought from Tony Resco that was adjacent to our part of the property. The way this came up, I wanted a fence to be erected between the two properties. Tony agreed to build that fence. The reason he agreed was that it was under municipal code. It was his obligation to build that fence and create a separation. And during the discussions about building that fence, I suggested to him, you know, I would be interested potentially in purchasing either 5 or 10 feet, a 5 or 10 foot strip alongside that property to widen my side yard. But I said that if it turned out that you had, if that was of interest to you and the rest of the lot was perfectly developable, then that's something that I would be interested in. So I threw that up in a relatively casual way. This was not a big deal to us. It was not something that was critical to our property values, but it was something that I thought would be nice because I've got a 9-year-old daughter and a 6-year-old daughter. And in fact, the way this came up was there was big swing set thing that went across both properties that we had to tear down. And constructing a new one, there wasn't going to be enough room. And so that's what triggered my thinking that it would be nice to widen the lot. He said that he would have his developer or surveyor, whatever the term is, come out and take a look and see how big the property would be and how much space they would need in terms to develop it to see if it was something that would be viable. I, in turn, asked my attorney to do an appraisal of what a fair price for that 10-foot strip would be or a 5-foot strip would be to make sure that I paid fair market value for such a transaction. The appraisal actually came back relatively low. It was something like $40,000. And that was attributable to the fact that there just aren't comps for a 10-foot strip of land, and that was noted by the appraiser. The appraisal, which is, by the way, all these documents are in there, the appraisal did note that the other parcel, Resco's remaining parcel, would be fully developable if he sold this to me. And so rather than pay the appraised price, I paid 1/6 of the cost of his property. He agreed to sell that 10-foot strip. I made sure that all the paperwork was done, and since we're in a landmarks district, that we contacted the Landmarks Commission. In fact, Michelle had once served on the Landmarks Commission board. She called somebody she knew down there to find out what regulations or requirements existed in terms of both erecting a fence and any other T's that had to be crossed or I's that had to be dotted. And so then the transaction went forward. Now, last point I'll make, I know I've been long-winded, but I figured I'd try to disgorge as much of this as possible, and then you guys can ask questions. The obvious question is, and this has been posed to me by the Tribune and by other news outlets, if you knew that this guy was already under a cloud of suspicion or was having problems, why would you go through with a transaction with him? The answer is that at least with respect to the purchase of the house, he wasn't involved in the purchase of my house. And at that time, the news around Resco's problems had not elevated to the levels that they did later. This is somebody who I'd known for a very long time. He had never asked me for favors and had not done me any favors. And so, although in looking backwards, I can see how it could have raised issues, it didn't at the time for me. And that can be considered a smaller lapse of judgment. A larger lapse of judgment existed when it came to the strip of property. Because at that time, I think it was clear that Resco was getting into bigger problems. And this was now a business transaction with him. And this is what I've referred to as a boneheaded move. But it is in the context of, you know, somebody, again, that I had known for a long time, who I was now a neighbor with, who, you know, that frankly I did not think was doing me a favor because I was paying a substantial amount of money, and he continued to have a developable piece of property. In retrospect, this was a error, and I've said so publicly and repeatedly. It was a mistake on my part. The mistake, by the way, was not just engaging in a transaction with Tony because he was having legal problems. The mistake was that he had been a contributor and somebody who was involved in politics, and I should not have engaged in a business dealing with him generally. And I've acknowledged that because it raised the appearance of impropriety. Having said that, the transaction was above board. I paid a full market price for it, and I don't think there have been any suggestions that I did not. So with that, let me stop.
When did you first realize that Tony Resco might be involved in the kind of influence peddling that he stands on trial for doing?
He became very active with the Blagojevich administration, so I was seeing him in Springfield. I had no indications that he was doing anything illegal. And since he's in trial, I don't want to in any way characterize what he did or did not do. I started reading the reports that were surfacing, I'll be honest with you that on the couple of occasions where it came up, he gave me assurances that there wasn't, that this was not, that he was not doing anything wrong and that it wasn't a problem. And there's no doubt that as things evolved, I became more concerned. But again, this is somebody who, in his interactions with me, had always been above board. And so my instinct was to believe him.
Do you recall when it first came up and how it came up?
I do not.
Thank you, Senator. You've recounted the fundraising, sir, and you've detailed about $220,000 to $250,000 over those years. Do you know, you mentioned that the state Senate campaign records weren't available to you. Can you just explain that for us a little bit?
Explain
the state senate records. Do you have records of the state senate?
Well, I mean, keep in mind that the any contributions were, you know, would have been filed under, you know, the state disclosure requirements for campaign financing. But, you know, my point is that I don't have internal records of, you know, who might have been a contributor that Tony Resko encouraged to contribute. You know, frankly, you know, I did not have a huge operation at that time with a lot of lawyers and staff.
So you did not keep those sorts of records at the time, or you kept them and you don't keep them?
Well, what I would have kept, I did not keep them because the records that I would have kept were the ones that were required for disclosure. You see what I'm saying? So there are records. We did everything that we needed to in terms of disclosing who made contributions, but I did not have a separate list of, okay, here are the people, you know, who are on a fundraising committee, and here are the, you know, people who they raised money from and so forth. Those records I don't have.
And
I'm not even sure I kept at that time, frankly.
Okay. Do you know at this point how many fundraisers Mr. Resko threw for you?
The only fundraiser that he held for me in the United States Senate race was the one at his home, which we've already talked to the Tribune about previously.
And
yeah.
Prior to that, do you know whether there were other fundraisers?
He never hosted anything at his home, and frankly, I don't recall him. I can't say it never happened because we're talking about over the course of 10 years, essentially. But I don't recall him hosting a fundraiser in which, you know, it was in his home or in his office in that way. He typically would participate as part of a larger group.
Thank you. And that June 2003 fundraiser that you have told us a lot about, we can't figure out who paid the expenses for that, such as catering, valet parking, et cetera. Can you help us with that?
You know, I can try to find out more. But the, I mean, typically what would happen would be that our campaign would offset costs that were attributable to our fundraising. They're subject to a rule that there's a certain portion that has to, there's a certain portion that can be contributed by the host above and beyond what they've already contributed financially.
Would that have been reported in the...
That should be reported.
Okay. Tony, obviously, as you mentioned, became involved in Blagojevich administration and was involved in recommending people for jobs.
Yes.
And boards and commissions. Did you have discussions with him about either recommendations that you sought for people or recommendations that he was making?
Well, frankly, you know, I've never had a big board organization or a lot of people who I'm finding jobs for. That just wasn't the nature of my office. I had one employee, and we had a district office director, and we had some volunteers who were otherwise employed. When the Blagojevich administration first came in, they contacted us and many other people asking for recommendations for people who might be interested in filling out state jobs. My recollection is that we sent a list of people, but it was not a list of people who I was particularly close to. I mean, if I'm not mistaken, it included people who came into our office asking for jobs or this or that or the other. I did not have any formal discussions with Tony beyond one individual, and that was Dr. Eric Whitaker, who ultimately became the head of the Illinois Department of Public Health, and who had been a longtime friend of mine who I'd known since he was getting his master's at Harvard and I was at the law school there. He had expressed an interest in that post. I think he had applied separately, but, you know, I don't recall whether I called Tony or he called me, and I simply said, I think this guy is outstanding, and is certainly somebody who's worthy of an interview.
And did you was your understanding that Tony was going to effectuate that within the Biden administration?
No. I mean, what I knew was, and I don't think this has been disputed, was that he was one of a number of people within the Blagojevich circle that were, helping to screen or interview potential candidates for, administration posts.
I was going to ask something about the transaction, if we could, going back. You said that he said to you he'd be interested in that lot. Mm-hmm. Did he elaborate? Did he say why he would be interested
in
that?
Well, you know, his... Again, I mean, this is a conversation that took place 4 years ago. So it may not have been one conversation. It may have been over a couple of conversations. My impression was that he thought that this lot could be valuable, that there were development opportunities there. My understanding was that he intended to develop it. As I said, I don't know all of his motives. There's no doubt in my mind that the fact that it was a lot next to a house that I was purchasing might have seemed attractive to him.
And from your point of view, a friend of yours is going to buy the lot next to your house.
Yes.
Normally you would ask him what he intended to do with it.
Well, no, I did ask him. I mean, I did ask him, and my understanding was that he was going to develop it. But as I said before, the notion of having somebody I know who, as far as I understood, was a experienced and well-regarded developer next to the lot was a good thing from my perspective.
You worked on politics, organizing communities.
Right.
You know them for 20 years, 17 years.
17 years.
Guy buys that lot next to you, buys the lot, buy the house. You never thought at any time he's going to ask me for something.
No. Precisely because I had known him for 17 years and he hadn't asked me for something. And there wasn't anything that was contingent. It's not as if I couldn't buy the house without him owning the lot. And frankly, I wanted the lot developed. I've said this before. You had a big yard. We had put up a fence. I couldn't use the lot. I'm a public figure. If you look at the configuration down 50, this is right on the corner of 51st Street, which is a very busy thoroughfare with a lot of buses going by, etc. And the idea of having a house next to us, pushing us away from 51st Street, was actually an attractive thing to me. In light of subsequent events, obviously, you can look back and say the red light should have gone off. And as I've said, it's something that I've acknowledged, would have been a mistake. But as far as the house is concerned, that was a purchase that we were negotiating with the sellers. And we had the ability to get that house.
So I'm completely wrong. If I had thought, and I have thought, that you needed Resco to buy that lot,
you are wrong.
Store, so you could afford that.
That is, and the seller has confirmed that that's completely wrong.
Brock, you talked about Tony taking over somebody's prior option on the lot.
Yes.
Was that Scott Winslow?
I confess I don't know the individual's name, and as I said, I wasn't involved with the in any way.
How did you learn that the person there was a, as you put it, a former employee of Tony's? And some
Tony told me.
Okay. When you talk to Tony about all of this stuff, obviously you have lawyers and he has lawyers, were you communicating entirely verbally or were your
just
lawyers?
By phone.
So these are emails and letters and correspondence going back?
I mean, the lawyers got involved in my purchase price with the house, but that was with the sellers. And presumably he had lawyers who he was dealing with in terms of the sellers.
And your conversations with Tony were entirely verbal, and
yes,
either on the phone or
Well, but and keep in mind the conversations weren't that extensive because the two transactions were separate.
I'm, missing something about when Tony submits his offer for the lot. Tony's taking the adjacent lot that's owned by somebody else. He tells you he's interested in it, and he knows this guy. But by the account you've given, I don't understand when he tells you, Brock, I'm going to get the lot next door.
Well, it was certainly before our closing, so I knew that. It was, I confess, I can't pinpoint that it that much further. Now, there were 10 days that elapsed between the first contract that we put in, sure, the first bid, and the ultimate closing.
Right.
Whether it took place before we put our first bid in, whether it took place after we put our first bid in, that I do not know.
Well, on that timeline, I'm a little, it sounds like things went very, very rapidly on your end. You've talked about this all happening in January 2005, and the first bid is January 15. So was my understanding correct that Michelle takes that drive with the broker and learns about this within days of the first bid coming in? Is that correct?
You know, we had been looking for some time. So this wasn't the first house that she had seen. She had probably taken a look at 8 or 10 houses.
In the December of 2004.
Yeah. And she had then narrowed it down to about 4 that she thought I should take a look at. I had taken a look at, I think, around 4. We had then seen this one. I took a look at this one. So we were, we were eager to make a purchase, make a decision, in part because trying to remember whether we already had an offer on our condo or not. But there were questions in terms of, as there usually are, in terms of how do you time moving out and moving in.
Of course. And the tour that you took with Tony, when we talked to you back in November 2006 and before when we first spoke with you, that wasn't something that came up. It wasn't something that you presumably recalled at the time.
You know, I confess that I thought what was important was that I brought this property to Tony's attention and asked him for his opinion. And so the fact that he had taken a physical tour was not something that I thought was new information.
It was something you knew at the time when we were asking you about it, but didn't feel it was...
I thought it was subsumed by the broader comment that I had contacted him, asking his opinion, asked him to take a look at the property.
Well, doesn't that walk through between you and Tony certainly fuel skepticism that there was a contingency and that there was a coordination of your bids? I mean, you're walking through.
I don't think so at all. Again, the seller has confirmed that the negotiations were entirely with them, that we gave them what they considered to be the best offer. And that the sale of the lot was completely separate.
Well, they may not have known what you guys were talking about. But
I don't understand. I don't understand how can we coordinate something if I'm negotiating with the seller, and and they have already sold an option on the lot, my purchase of the house is in no way contingent on the purchase of the lot.
Okay. The tour was only with you and Tony, and nobody else participated in that tour.
Oh, I think my broker, Miriam Zelserman, I think was there because she probably would have gotten the keys.
Okay.
Can I say this though? Also,
please, yes.
I mean, the fact that he took a physical tour, I don't understand how that's any different than if I had talked to him on the phone. I mean, you know, we're just having a conversation.
I ask because, again, the overriding question about all this and the one that you've been trying to address, I think since the very beginning, but the one that's still lingering, is whether or not you and Tony coordinated your purchases of the home.
Well, and I guess what I'm saying is that if we've got confirmation from the seller that the two transactions weren't related, that we, in fact, paid the best price or gave them the best offer for the home, then why the thought that I coordinated would be relevant. I mean, the overarching suspicion that has been raised by a number of reporters in this room was that there was some sort of subsidy of my house. If that is in fact not the case, then that should allay whatever concerns you have, unless there's something that I'm missing.
No, sir, we have never communicated with the sellers, and your transmission of their emails to us is the first that we've had of them.
No, well, I understand. I recognize that. And I should probably make mention of this. Part of the difficulty that we've had on some of these responses has to do with the fact that the sellers are very private people, and we're not interested in being drawn into a media circus. And just to give you some indication of what they, what might prompt their concerns, one reporter got a hold of their 11-year-old daughter's cell phone and asked for them. One showed up at their house at 9:30 at night. Another somehow got through security at John Hopkins and started asking questions of the woman doctor who was on rounds there. And so, not surprisingly then, this was not something that they were eager to get involved with. They are the ones, though, that did originally indicate to us when they first read the reports that this is just not accurate. And after some prodding, then we were able to get them to at least respond to a set of points that my lawyer laid out, our campaign lawyer laid out, so that they could confirm this. And again, you know, this is subject to confirmation.
I appreciate that. I'm also, our contacts with them has been entirely respectful of their privacy.
No, this was not in any way suggesting that you guys hadn't been respectful. I'm just saying that if you're not running for president, dealing with the national press is not something that people really look forward to.
Yeah.
For me, it's great.
Senator, can I try to understand a little bit the virtue that you and Michelle saw in developing that lot? I don't think 51st is all that busy. It's not 47th or 55th. And it seems that that there is virtue in having that empty lot, particularly with the wall of evergreens that went up along the south side.
And yeah, I mean, I guess there are different aesthetic opinions. We did not think that I could see an advantage of having the whole thing and then maybe, you know, doing something with that. We were building a fence. We didn't own the lot. And having a house there would have been, from my perspective, probably preferable, partly because those evergreens are not rock solid. People often peer into our house, or at least they did until Secret Service showed up, and they're less likely to do so now.
And you never had a conversation with Mr. Resco about would he keep that vacant so you'd have that?
No.
It was clearly your understanding that he
My understanding was that he was going to be developing the property.
And did he ever make any movement in that direction? Was there any effort to develop it?
He had owned a lot of lots. I don't know, but what I know is that he was involved in a very big development downtown. I don't think that this was sort of at the top of his list. And by the time that, in any situation, the pace of developing a lot might not be immediate. Apparently he was in legal trouble at this point. So I don't know his motives or what was going on at that time.
Senator, do you know anything now about the prospective buyer? Is it a friend of his? A friend of yours?
No. It's not anybody I know, and my understanding is they're gonna build a house on.
We had a meeting this week with the director of the FBI, and he didn't say Chicago was number one for public corruption, but he made it clear the city keeps him plenty busy.
Right.
Do you think, in context of running for president, does coming out of the political environment of Chicago help or hinder in terms of how the nation looks at a Chicago politician?
Senator Clinton comes out of New York, and you know there are apparently some issues there as well. I think that all of you have been following my career for some time. I have done a good job in rising politically in this environment without being entangled in some of the traditional problems of Chicago politics. I know that there are those like John Cass who would like me to decry Chicago politics more frequently. I'll leave that to his editorial commentary. But I think that I think it's fair to say that I've conducted myself in my public office with great care and high ethical standards. The fact that there's such an intense focus on this, and there are no other indications of anything in which I've even come close to the line, I think is an indication. It doesn't excuse the mistake I made here, but it does indicate, I think, that the American people are going to be judging me based on my behavior and my actions, and those have been above board.
I just wanted to go back to Tony for just a second. I mean, he has collected over the years a large following of political friends such as you. What is it about Tony that's so appealing to you guys? What do you like about Tony? Is it just the money, or is there something?
No. As I said before, in my interactions with him, he was very gracious. He did not ask me for favors. He did not ask me for he was not obtrusive. He wasn't one of these people who would insist on coming around all the time or being photographed with me constantly, or you didn't get a sense that there were a whole host of motives or agendas there. He was very loyal. As I said when I ran for Congress, he supported me over Congressman Rush, and that was a difficult decision for him. So it felt like a very comfortable friendship.
Senator, aside from the fundraiser specifically, could you talk a little bit about what other friends or donors he's introduced you to who are still helpful to you?
It's hard to recall who, what sort of intersections there are here in town and sort of who I met who through, because I obviously know a lot of people now in Chicago.
I presume that is the way he was helpful to you, though, introducing you to people.
I'll be honest with you. That actually is he was helpful to me, as I said, early in my career, not so much introducing, but reinforcing relationships with aldermen that he knew on the South Side, mainly because of his development work. And in terms of his fundraising, frankly, I think most of the people that he raised money from were business associates or friends of his who I did not end up getting establishing deep relationships with. I mean, there were people who might have come to a fundraiser with him who would introduce me. I would say hello, make some small talk. I can't think of anybody who's been a lasting supporter of mine who was introduced to me through him.
In the question that Bruce asked about difficulties of coming out of Chicago, the Chicago political way, and when you were here several months, maybe a year ago, you said either here or I forget outside, we're outside, that I think it was right here in the room, that if you were, that you would reappoint or seek to maintain
Patrick Fitzgerald
as the United States
Attorney. I think I said it here in the boardroom.
Given the investigations that are going on now, if you're elected president, would you?
I still think he's doing a good job.
Would you?
Yes.
Keep him. And why would you keep him?
I think he has been aggressive in putting the city on notice and the state on notice that he takes issues of public corruption seriously.
Does that position of wanting to keep the prosecutor in the job, does that perhaps, do you think it threatens or compromises any other political entities here in Chicago?
I can't speculate on that, John. I can't. I would leave it. You can, yes.
David, there's a couple other questions on Resco.
Thank you. When Tony titled the garden lot in his wife's name, didn't that strike you as odd?
I had no idea why he did it. I don't think he was intending to hide something, because if he was, then, using your wife's name, Rita Resco, probably wouldn't have been the best way to do it.
Did he ever explain to you what he was doing? When did you discover it wasn't her?
I didn't discover it until the issue of him purchasing this lot broke through through you.
When we talked back in 2006, you mentioned that you paid the legal and the permitting fees for the fence,
mm-hmm.
and said that you were looking to see how much that was, how much you spent on that.
How much I spent on that?
Yeah, did you ever determine that?
I confess that I didn't look at it carefully, but I'm sure we could find out. As I said, it would have been, I'm assuming, a couple of $1,000, because I had my lawyer, who's still my real estate lawyer, Bill Maselli, do it. He could probably pull the bills on that.
Was the paying for the fence by Tony, would you consider that a gift?
No. He was obligated to do so under the municipal code.
And you paid for the landscaping, and again, that was something that the amount of money you were paying to landscape Tony's lot, to mow his lawn and so forth, you were not sure of how much that was when we talked back in 2006.
Yeah, but I can give you a fairly accurate assessment, which is that, we were probably paying $100 to a couple of $100 a month. I mean, this is basically mowing a lawn and maybe trimming some brush. And so his half of it, I mean, I know that we actually got this reimbursed by the subsequent seller or the subsequent owner. And so I can probably get you that figure, but I can't imagine it's more than $1,000 or so.
Paid you back for the amount that you'd spent.
That's right.
Okay, and when that happened in the last year or so, or last
yes.
few months.
Yeah.
You don't know the amount, but it's
I don't
done.
Know. times are hard right now, so I don't want to call it a nominal amount, but it was not a exorbitant amount.
When the trial came up with Tony, one of the things that's disclosed is that in two instances, totaling $10,000. Tony's allegedly used straw donors to funnel money to your campaign.
Yes.
Have you conducted any sort of internal investigation to determine if there's other instances in your campaign?
Yes, we have tried to. Well, what we have done is we have tried to exercise an excess of caution subsequent to those disclosures. So any money that we can trace to Tony, we have disgorged.
Do you think he used you?
I'll be honest with you. I don't. I don't think that. I think that he treated me as a friend and with respect. And he did not ask me to do things. He did not advertise our relationships generally. you know, he operated with me in an above board fashion. Now, I can't speak to anything beyond my relationship with him.
Just between you and him.
Just between.
Did you ever think that the bill would come due, the political bill would come due, and you get a call and come in and say, you know what, I really need this.
No, because I'd known him for a long time, and so I would have. I assumed I would have seen a pattern over the course of 15 years.
Brock, one letter writer wrote to the Tribune and asked us, gosh, if Resco can do this good of a job of luring Brock and getting into transactions with him, what is Brock going to do when he meets some of the wily characters that come trucking through the Oval Office? How's he going to handle a Putin or an Abramoff or one of the characters that come looking for favors and looking for liaisons and relationships?
Well, look, I think that... as I said before, I've navigated some fairly difficult territory in my political career. There's some folks in Springfield who are pretty wily. And I've always been able to operate effectively, but also do so in a way that was consistent with my values and my ethics. I make no claims of perfection, but I think that generally my judgment and my assessments of people have been very good, and that's part of how I've stayed out of trouble in what can be a pretty hurly-burly political environment.
This issue of judgment is one of the keynotes of your campaign right now, and it's one of the things you talked to us about, the two instances where you mentioned what you call shortfalls or matches in your judgment. How should Americans look at this series of events that you've just laid out?
I think that what they should, the way they should view it is that that I made a mistake in not seeing the potential conflicts of interest or appearances of impropriety. But they should see somebody who was not engaged in any wrongdoing, who did not in any way betray the public trust, who has maintained consistently high ethical standards, and who they can trust.
There's been some sense that you've treated Senator Clinton with kid gloves on the issue of ethical standards. If she were to do a session like this, we ought to ask her about it.
Well, you know, I think that the one thing that we have talked about is that, or that I talked about this in the debate, and I think subsequent to the debate, she has essentially made two arguments for her, for why she should be the nominee rather than me. The argument number one is that she is more qualified to be commander-in-chief. We have argued that it's very important to focus attention on those claims because, I actually think that her notion that she is vastly more experienced and more qualified for being commander-in-chief are simply wrong. The second argument that she's made is that she's been thoroughly vetted, and I have not. And she uses this Resco incident as Exhibit A. And I think that it is important if she thinks that that is sort of one of her rationales for being the nominee, that somehow I'm more vulnerable to Republican attack than she is, that issues like disclosing her income tax returns, disclosing the donors to the Clinton Library are very relevant. Disclosing her earmarks, which we just did. Those issues of transparency and accountability, I think, are important. I would suggest that she should match our approach on all those issues.
You got an earmark request for the University of Chicago where your wife works. Is that a mistake?
You know, frankly, the we should probably, the University of Chicago is a major constituency of ours. I mean, they're a major employer in my state and a very important one. So I don't think that I was obligated to recuse myself from anything related to the university. When it comes to earmarks because of those concerns, it's probably something that should have been passed on to Dick Durbin, and I think probably slipped through the cracks. It did not come through us, through me, or Michelle, and Michelle's been very careful about staying separate and apart from any government work. But I think there, I think you can make a good argument that this is one that slipped through our cracks, through our screening system.
The issue of Geraldine Ferraro in the whole business, then comes the video of old comments that your pastor Jeremiah Wright has made. How are we to look at these? What's the best way to look at this? And in what context do you put them in the American people?
Well, you know, I think they're separate issues, but there is a relationship, and you know, I think you're touching on something that's worth talking about. I think with respect to Geraldine Ferraro, I don't think what she said was racist, and I was asked about this, and I said I didn't think that was what it was. I do think that what she said was wrong. The notion, you know, the implication was that I was a affirmative action beneficiary. You know, I think you can make an argument that my race might have played a role in my selection for the 2004 convention. But it doesn't account for the fact that it was a pretty good speech. I think that my persona, obviously includes the fact that I'm African American. And so to the extent that how I talk about issues of race and how I present myself is attractive to some voters, I think is undeniable. But to suggest that I could have gotten through the gauntlet of the last 13 months against very experienced, very savvy, skilled politicians and find myself in the lead for the Democratic nomination against, including against the dominant political machine, the Democratic Party, over the last 20 years, seems pretty dismissive. Not just dismissive of me, but dismissive of voters. This idea that, oh, you know, let's get a black guy in there, I think just doesn't make sense. So I think that it was looking at an issue through a racial lens that doesn't make perfect sense. I mean, she could have made a subtle point about the role of race in my candidacy that could have been interesting. That this wasn't it. All right, so that's Geraldine Ferraro. Reverend Wright, he preached his last sermon. He's now in retirement. I've put out a statement today. I'll be honest with you. This is somebody who I've known for 20 years. I basically came to the church and became a member of the church through Trinity and through him. He's the person who gave me the line, "The Audacity of Hope." He is somebody who, you know, he's a former Marine, is a biblical scholar, has taught and lectured at, major theological seminaries all across the country and has been very widely regarded and admired. He hasn't been my political advisor. He's been my pastor. And I have to say that the clips that have been shown over the last couple of days are deeply disturbing and to me. Because I wasn't in church during those sermons. the things he said and the way he said them, I think, are offensive. And I reject them. And they don't reflect who I am and what I believe in. Now, in fairness to him, this was sort of a greatest hits of, yeah, right? I mean, they basically culled five or six sermons out of 30 years of preaching. That doesn't excuse them. And I've said so very clearly. But that's not the relationship I had with him. That's not the relationship I had with the church. And if I had heard those kinds of statements being said, if I had been in church on those days, I would have objected fiercely to them, and I would have told him so personally. Now he is now when some of these statements first came to light was right around when I was starting to run for president. He was a year away from retirement, and the church itself is a pillar of the community and a well-regarded, well-known church. I suspect there are members of the Tribune family that are also members of Trinity. It is not what's been painted as this separatist church or what have you. It is a very traditional African-American church on the south side of Chicago. And most of Reverend Wright's sermons are very traditional African-American, the sermons of a traditional African-American pastor. And so my view was that it would not be appropriate for me to distance myself from the church. I put out a statement saying I profoundly disagree with these statements. And, you know, the fact that he's now retiring makes me not want to simply discard him. You know, he's like a member of the family. He's like your uncle who says things that you profoundly disagree with, but he's still your uncle. Now,
they see, and rightly so, Geraldine Ferraro, in my opinion, personal opinion, yeah. She's asked to leave, she leaves the campaign, right. She should have left.
Yes.
Okay, and some people see that, legitimately yes. So. Right. Then, how should we see
I think people should raise legitimate concerns about it. And the fact that he's retiring, and we've got a young pastor, Otis Moss, coming in, means that people should understand the context of this relationship, that this is an aging pastor who's about to retire, and that I have made and will make some very clear statements about how profoundly I disagree with these statements. I don't think they are reflective of the church. They're certainly not reflective of my views. Now, just last point I would make, and then, John, you can pick up on the question. I do think there's an overlap in the sense that there is a generational shift that is taking place and has constantly taking place in our society. And Reverend Wright is somebody who came of age in the 60s. And so, like a lot of African-American men, of fierce intelligence coming up in the 60s, he has a lot of the language and the memories and the baggage of those times. And I represent a different generation with just a different set of life experiences, and so see race relations in very different terms than he does, as does Otis Moss, who is slightly younger than me. And so, the question then for me becomes, what's my relationship to that past? I can completely just disown it and say I don't understand it, but I do understand it. I mean, I understand, the context with which he developed his views, but also can still reject unequivocally
a lot of those. You won't reject the man.
Yeah, exactly. And now the same, I think, and this is where the connection comes in. I mean, I do think that Geraldine Ferraro, the lens through which she looks at race, is different. She's 70 years old. She's grown up in different times, and the Queens that she grew up is, I'm sure, a different place than it was then. Just as Chicago is a different place than it was then. And so, so part of my job is to see if I can help push the country into a different place with a different set of understandings. But as I said, it doesn't excuse what Reverend said. I, 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 and I'm very troubled by it. And if I, as I said, if I'd heard those sermons, if I had been there when those sermons were taking place, I would have raised that with him. And if I had thought that that was the message that was being promoted on a consistent basis in that church, I don't think I could be consistently a part of it.
So we only have a few minutes left with you, and I want to make sure we cover a few things.
Go ahead.
The economy in Michigan Delegates. Samantha Powers, a lot of people want to talk for you these days. Samantha,
yes.
Quoted as saying your Iraq withdrawal plan is a best case scenario.
Right.
Is that how you see it?
What I have said consistently is that there are strategic questions around Iraq and there are tactical questions around Iraq. The strategic question is, is it time for us to begin withdrawal? And the answer is yes. And so what I've said is that I would call in my Joint Chiefs of Staff immediately upon taking office, give them a clear message, which is we need to begin a phased withdrawal. My understanding is that we can withdraw at a pace of 1 to 2 brigades per month, and that at that pace, we would have our combat troops out in approximately 16 months, depending on what troop levels were when I'd been sworn in. What I've also said is that I will always listen to commanders on the ground, and I always reserve the right as commander-in-chief to do what I think is in the best interests of America's national security. And so if I have strong evidence that we need to modify the pace of withdrawal to ensure the safety of troops, of course that's something that I'm going to take into consideration. But the overarching belief on my part is that we have to set a timetable, send a clear message to the Iraqis. There was an interview with General Petraeus just this morning, in which he indicated, as I've believed for a very long time, that the Iraqi government has not taken advantage of the lowering levels of violence in the ways that it should. That's his assessment. And that we've got to put pressure on the Iraqis to stand up.
President Bush today has said essentially, don't panic. Do you think the country is in a recession, heading to a recession, and how quickly do you think Congress will be able to respond?
Well, a couple of points. In traveling around the country this year, regardless of whether we were technically in recession, there was a significant amount of anxiety and hardship among the American people well before Wall Street got notice of. Wages and incomes have flatlined, and costs have been going up on everything from health care to gas at the pump. So there is no doubt with the subprime lending crisis and the credit crunch that we are in a bad economic situation. I hate to say whether we're in a recession or not. I believe that we will find out that we are already in the midst of a recession, but I can't speak to the technical data yet. We don't have it. But what is indisputable is that the economy has slowed down substantially, that investment, job growth have contracted, that the credit market is frozen, and that we're going to have to break out of it. I think that the Federal Reserve has lowered interest rates. They've tried some creative ways to pump more liquidity into the system and unlock the credit markets. But until those credit markets have more confidence that there's been a bottoming out of the bad debt and paper that's out there, I think we're going to continue to have problems. And part of our job then is, part of Congress's job is not only, I think, to try to prime the pump through the stimulus package that was already passed. But I also think a critical area is to shore up the housing market. I'm glad to see that the President and Paulson have put forward some proposals. They're mostly prospective. I'm working with Senator Dodd on a mechanism to put some floor beneath the housing market, one that does not advantage speculators or people who are flipping properties, but at least gives some confidence that you're not just going to see a irrational plunge in the housing market. There is going to definitely be some declines in housing values before they pick back up, but there's a big difference as to whether that decline is 10%, 20%, or 40%. And I think that it's important for Congress to act even as the Federal Reserve is acting, to make sure that we are providing some confidence in that market.
Senator Obama, the Fed stepped in today on this Bear Stearns deal,
right.
And do you think, first of all, that was appropriate action at this point, and are you concerned at all about the precedent of bailing out a big bank like this?
Well, you know, I haven't seen all the details yet because this happened as I was traveling, so I'd want to take a look at how they structured it. You know, I can tell you that, you know, my general philosophy on this is that intervening in bubbles that burst are not always helpful and can just delay the pain. And there's going to be some pain in the credit markets because there was a lot of irresponsible loan activity out there. On the other hand, I do think that what you don't want is a cascading decline in the credit markets across the board that makes that where you start seeing companies that are sound or debt that is sound being punished as well. And drawing that line is difficult. I think there are times where you've got to be pragmatic and say, theoretically, you don't want a bailout, but in this situation, you don't want a collapse of the financial markets. That's why I want to take a look at the specific details of it, but that's the general approach that I would take.
Senator, if I could just ask, and I know we're running out of time, but the last time you visited with us in this room,
right.
You were on the eve of your Hawaii vacation, and it was the time where you and Michelle are going to...
Right.
You're going to quit smoking and decide whether or not you were going to run for the presidency.
Right.
And, you know, your two memoirs show impressive ability, a habit of introspection and thinking about times as you're in them. If here we are, you know, a year and a couple of months later, you made the decision, you plunged into it, you're now quite possibly on the eve of the nomination. And when you think about that time, you know, looking back to that conversation, now flashing forward, what have you learned about yourself? What's different than what you expected before you got in that plane?
You know, the campaign is, in some ways, has exceeded expectations, obviously. I didn't expect the levels of excitement that we've generated, particularly among young people and people who haven't participated in the process before. I mean, I thought that we could tap into some of that. I didn't think it would be at such high levels. And that has been one of the great pleasures of the campaign. I mean, seeing the spontaneous organization and frankly, I've been shocked about our ability to raise funds. I mean, in February, 90% of our donations came over the internet. 50% were less than $50. 50%, and we raised $55 million. I mean, I literally didn't have a fundraiser. I mean, there's just that sense of excitement and interest. And so the feeling that we were tapping into something that's real, that there's this genuine hunger for a different kind of politics, less rancor, a politics that wasn't special interest driven, you know, that I think I've been very pleased with. I did not expect the campaign to last so long, the primary. Frankly, I think all of us thought that by February 5th this would be over. At this point, I don't think it will be over until the last contest, which may or may not be Puerto Rico on June 1st. And so it's been an endurance test. And I think that I've learned that I can work 7 days a week for 13 months and not collapse. I have learned that I have a temperament that I think is suitable to the presidency, and as well as campaigning for the presidency, in that I don't get too up when I'm up and I don't get too down when I'm down. And I've been, I think, fairly steady. And I've learned how to be a better candidate, how to, at least outside of editorial boards meetings, keeping my answers shorter. I think I'm a much better debater in the traditional debate context than I was the first time. I mean, I guess after 20 debates, either you get better or you are voted off the island. What I found, partly because of the length of the campaign, is that you have to constantly renew yourself and what you're saying and what you're doing. And I think that is a challenge because there's such a premium on the next thing and make the next appearance and getting out there and maintaining momentum. And so, I actually think that after the 11 victories that we had right before Ohio and Texas, part of what happened was that, what I was saying started getting stale because you didn't have time to step out of it and sort of say, is what I'm saying true? Am I connecting? Am I getting at the heart of things? Or is it just becoming performance? And I think, that probably cost us a little bit in addition to some flubs that we made in those last 3 days. But I think that, and to some extent, I think the same thing happened after Iowa. You're working so hard, you're churning and going at it, and you're passionate about it, and you are connecting with people, and you're just right there, and then you win, and then there's this tendency to sort of just keep on doing the same thing. But the truth is that, this process is dynamic, and it's not, you can't just keep on doing the same thing over and over again. And I assume that the presidency is the same way, that you have to constantly grow in it, and just because what you've done has been working doesn't mean that what you're doing is right for that stage. And so I've got to constantly push myself, I think, to step back and say, all right, this stump, is what I'm saying here really real, or am I just going through the motions? Am I really listening to these people, who are telling me about losing their job, and connecting with them and trying to figure out how to make their lives better? Sometimes I've been good at it and sometimes I haven't been good at it, but I think that's the test of leadership. And I think the voters, for all the flood of information that's coming at them, I think they sense when you're real and when you're true and when you're not. And that's something that you have to keep up.
One last question. I believe it's been 16 months since we first invited you to suggested that you deal forthrightly with Fresco. Yeah. And put behind you. We've suggested that several times since. Should we have had this conversation a long time ago? And may I ask why we haven't?
I'll be honest with you. I sort of had felt like we had, and I'm not saying we were right, but I think part of what happened was we had a fairly extensive and thorough press conference around this issue. We talked to your reporters repeatedly, the Sun-Times reporters repeatedly, gave them a lot of information, talked to the Washington Post, appeared on all the Sunday shows, and the fact is my answers really haven't changed much. So to that extent, I think that part of the reason we didn't have this conversation was the feeling was maybe we had the conversation, and what had changed was not so much my answers as it was that I looked now like I was a really viable presidential candidate and Tony Resco had been indicted. So that it was the circumstances of the individuals involved that had changed as opposed to the story. Now, having said that, I also, as I said before, part of our difficulty was that the sellers were very reticent to come forward. And so, I think clearly disputing the implications or the appearances of this stuff, other than simply telling folks what had gone on, it wasn't clear that we had new information to provide. And some of it is probably, this is, Anne-Marie asked what I've learned. Learning the relationship with the press in a national campaign is a challenge. I will say this. There is no experience similar to this in terms of living in the fishbowl. There are times where very legitimate and fair questions are raised about my inconsistencies or contradictions or foibles. And then there are times where, folks are just picking at you, because they need some copy. And, it can induce a mentality of let's be very protective of information and interviews and access so that we can try to control the narrative a little bit more. And that's something that we've got to be careful of, not just as a candidate, but presumably even more so as president. What you want to do is balance not responding to every whim of every reporter out there with maintaining a sense of openness and accessibility and willingness to engage the criticisms that are made of you. And that's something that, we're still learning as a team, and I'm still learning as a candidate.
Senator, we want you to come back, so we better let you go.
Thank you. Appreciate you. Thank you.
You're good to come in today, Brock. It's good to see you. Great. We're grandparents now.
Oh, congratulations. Well, you're pretty young looking,
you
Grandpa.
You get some time.